Good morning, and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Filmmakers Ken Burns, Sebastian Younger, and Lynn Novick on America's Forever Wars by Lily Rothman. When it comes to war, some things never change. Though we may battle on new ground and with new weapons, there's always the fact of the fighting and the fact that stories of war in all their savage nuance draw us in again and again. And when it comes to telling those stories, few people are more experienced than Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, and Sebastian Younger. Burns and Novick have most recently brought their documentary filmmaking experience to the story of the war that divided the United States a half century ago. Their series, The Vietnam War, premiered this month, whereas Younger has examined contemporary wars as a journalist and documentary filmmaker, most recently turning to Syria in the film Hell on Earth. For the latest installment of Influencers, a Time series that brings people together for one-of-a-kind conversations, the three spoke about their experiences telling war stories. All quickly agreed that one of the central questions they face is why these tales seem to repeat so reliably, and why we cannot look away from them despite the death and destruction war brings. One reason, Burns suggests, is that war is human nature on steroids, bringing out not just the worst of humanity, but also the best. Disaster and danger imbue experiences with meaning, and those who have been to the front lines together, literally or figuratively, are never the same. The question, then, is whether and how a society can achieve that sense of solidarity without the killing. It's a particularly pertinent question for the United States in the 21st century, Younger argues. Modern society, he says, is easy on the body and hard on the mind. But though that problem remains an urgent one, these three experts are ready to propose a solution. The dictionary is adding an entry for fake news by Katie Steinmetz. Katie Steinmetz is Time's San Francisco bureau chief, covering news and ideas in the American West. In addition to writing features for Time and Time.com, she pens a column on language and organizes the occasional spelling bee. Imagine that it's your job to explain what everyone else means when they use certain words, whether the term in question is escalator or nationalism. That is the task of the lexicographer, the human who watches words spread and tracks the way people use them. You might even call them fact-checkers for the English language. Their mission of keeping dictionaries current has always been a challenging one, and President Donald Trump is not making it any easier. In Dictionary.com's next update, the online reference will add a definition for the term fake news. And even though Trump is partly responsible for the currency of that phrase, the definition won't be true to the way he generally uses the term, so much as the way it's used to describe alleged attempts by Russia to meddle in the 2016 election. The entry will read like this. Fake news, false news stories, often of a sensational nature, created to be widely shared online for the purpose of generating ad revenue via web traffic or discrediting a public figure, political movement, company, etc. Trump might claim that this definition works just fine, that when he sums up all the work done by CNN, ABC, CBS, The New York Times, and The Washington Post as fake news in a single tweet, this is precisely what he means, that those outlets are producing false stories aimed at discrediting him, public figure number one. So they caught fake news CNN cold, but what about NBC, CBS, and ABC, Trump tweeted. What about the failing New York Times and Washington Post? They are all fake news. Although Trump does deploy the term to highlight errors, both the president and his supporters use fake news to cast a wide net over plenty of articles that are chock full of truth and facts. In general, the Trumpian version of the phrase functions more as a slur against mainstream media outlets that some conservatives believe are inherently flawed by an unacknowledged liberal bias. Americans don't seem to agree on much these days, including the meaning of words, and that goes doubly for politically fraught ones. Even terms like white supremacy are undergoing shifts. While some might hear white supremacy and envision neo-Nazis advocating for a white ethnic state, others are now using the term to refer to societies in which white people have historically had rights other groups have not, to vote or to own land, and continue to have privileges others do not. In the former sense, it's an odious vision. In the latter, it's reality. Trump has put other words on lexicographers' watch lists, too, as when he thrust the term alt-left into the public consciousness after the clash between white nationalists and counter-protesters in Charlottesville. It was a complicated linguistic pivot, given all the talk about how people should be qualifying the term alt-right, which can function as a euphemism for hateful racism and sexism, as well as an unfair insult to more traditional conservative ideologies. No major English dictionary has added alt-left to their ranks yet, although some have defined alt-right. That's because it's not yet clear whether the term will stick around or exactly how people will be using it if it does. The same goes for the way that Trump decries quote-unquote fake news. There are two very real senses of fake news out there, says Dictionary.com's Jane Solomon, and we've chosen in our next update to only define one of them. In part, she says, that decision turned on the lexicographer's principle of defining what is probable versus what is possible. Many people have been turning to dictionaries to look up a definition for fake news. Oxford says it's one of their most common failed searches these days, and Solomon wants people to get a definition that reflects the wider understanding of what fake news means. Dictionary.com's choice also reflects lexicographers' deep commitment to neutrality. They don't define words because they like them or write definitions that fit their ways of thinking. They do their best to mechanically reflect and distill the ways in which English speakers are using words in daily life. Sometimes that means adding usage notes about the context in which a word was popularized, or adding a label like slang or derogatory in front of the definition. A dictionary is not a censored resource, Solomon says. But sometimes that commitment means not adding a definition at all. A word's inclusion in a dictionary confers legitimacy on both words and the meanings that accompany them, which is why definitions are summoned in legal arguments and cited in court opinions. And that is why no respectable dictionary is ever going to write a definition for fake news that simply reads, "The Failing New York Times." Merriam-Webster does not seem to have been inspired by Trump's usage of fake news so far. That reference does not have a definition for the term, and has said they're unlikely to add one because the meaning is self-explanatory. Fake news is news that is untrue, so the term doesn't need its own entry, just as red car or hot day does not. Craig Leland, a senior editor at the Oxford English Dictionary who works on new words, says that they're keeping a close eye on the phrase but have not broken out their definition writing pens yet because the meaning is still evolving. The term has been used since the 1800s, he says, and for most of that time, its meaning was obvious, no more than a synonym for false news or spurious news. But fake news has gained an extra layer of meaning since gaining prominence over the last year, he says, so that now there's a case for us to define it. The fact is that we have more words than we want to define than we have the resources or time to define them, says Solomon. We're trying to keep up, she says, but these words are sprouting up so fast. Republicans are optimistic about tax reform, but it could face the same trouble as health care. By Nash Jenkins. Republican lawmakers gathered with excitement on Wednesday to introduce their proposal for what they described as the most sweeping federal tax reform proposal in decades. Just a day after the latest failure on their promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act, the change of topic was welcomed, and the members gathered in the Rayburn Room were optimistic about the new proposal. "I like the energy in the room," said Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio. "There's a real exciting opportunity. It gets the economy moving and will generate more income, more wages. It's more jobs, it's better jobs." Endorsed by President Trump in Indiana on Wednesday, the plan is being billed as a drastic simplification of the federal tax system, one that is, quote, "built for growth and puts America first," with an emphasis on helping the middle class. But like the healthcare fight before it, the proposal came with a number of unanswered questions that could frustrate lawmakers' goals. The blueprint, titled United Framework for Fixing Our Broken Tax Code, runs at just 9 pages, 8 if you subtract the title page, and deals mostly in broad strokes. And the specifics that are there have already engendered skepticism among Democrats and nonpartisan tax experts. To take one example, the framework calls for reducing the number of income tax brackets from its current 7 down to 3, taxed at 12%, 25%, and 35%. This idea by itself would amount to a tax hike on the poorest Americans, who currently pay a 10% federal income tax rate, and a tax cut for the rich, who pay 39.6%. It will be up to Congress to decide what the income cutoffs are for each bracket. Supporters argue that the bill will include a trade-off, simplifying the tax code enough that Americans could file their taxes on the back of a postcard. That means getting rid of many itemized deductions in favor of a larger standard deduction. But the plan fails to specify exactly which deductions would go, noting only that it will retain incentives for charitable donations and the mortgage interest deduction for homeowners. Trump has long called for a significant slashing of corporate taxes, and the new proposal delivers on that. It would reduce the current corporate tax rate from 35% to around 20%, earning the proposal the support of conservative House Republicans, and limit the tax rate on small businesses to around 25%, which are currently taxed as individuals. It's worth noting that many of the specifics laid out in the blueprint will likely benefit Trump himself. He owns more than 500 small pass-through businesses under the broad umbrella of the Trump Organization that will enjoy a significant tax cut. The plan also eliminates the alternative minimum tax, which often hits Americans making more than $130,000, and does away with the estate tax, which would factor into his children's inheritance. The proposal fails to explain how it will pay for all of this. According to some reports, one proposed strategy is repealing the state and local income tax deduction, a century-old measure that allows taxpayers to deduct the sum they pay in local and state taxes from the amount that is then taxed at the federal level. This will inevitably draw the ire of lawmakers from states that benefit heavily from the deduction, high tax, generally blue states like New York and California. Firstly, it's an attempt at tax reform, but it's really just a tax cut, and there's no doubt in my mind that in its current form it will likely increase the deficit. Steve Bell, who served as staff director for the Senate's Committee on the Budget from 1981 to 1986 and is now a senior advisor at the Bipartisan Policy Center, tells Time. By how much? We don't know. No one can say, because we don't know the details behind some of these provisions. There has been a real complaint, especially in the Senate, by Republican lawmakers who haven't participated in this process, now that the best they're getting is a few pages of really sketchy stuff, Bell continued. There are a lot of Republicans who would like to know a lot more about this. I can guarantee you that the final bill, if one even emerges, will be substantially different than this. Still, Wednesday was a day for optimism among the GOP. In the 8 months that have passed since Trump took the Oval Office and Republicans took the majority in both houses of Congress, the party's first such trifecta in a decade, the Republican Party has notched 0 major legislative victories. Its failures have been loud and public. Most recently, the death earlier this week of the last-ditch Obamacare repeal effort known as Graham Cassidy, which many Republicans clung to until the end as a possible Hail Mary pass on a pledge dating back to 2010. Conservative experts are bullish. This is going to be an extremely popular thing, and it will pass before December. Grover Norquist, the outspoken anti-tax advocate who heads the action group Americans for Tax Reform, tells Time. Trump has focused the rhetoric on jobs, 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 and this is much more a jobs bill than it is a tax cut bill. Asked if achieving tax reform was a more reasonable goal than repealing Obamacare, Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah demurred. I think they're both difficult, but this is one that attracts more attention and gets people working a little harder, said Hatch, one of the leading figures in the tax reform effort. It's a question of when we bring it up. We can do it now if we have to. This isn't exactly true. For starters, Republicans in Congress must first pass a budget resolution that will allow the Senate to pass a tax reform bill with just a simple majority of 51 votes. A draft is expected to hit the Senate floor next week. Only then will lawmakers go to work to hash out a bill deemed palatable. But Democrats are already on the offensive, decrying the plan as an unjust tax cut for the wealthy. Their plan is clear: slash rates for the wealthiest among us and stick the middle class with the check, Democratic Representative Tim Ryan from Ohio said Wednesday in a statement. Of course we're taking it seriously. Their health care bill was an absurd proposal, and so is this, one senior Democratic aide tells Time. It's fundamentally a tax cut for the wealthy, and if this remains the framework, it's hard to expect bipartisan work on it. You can't tinker around with fundamental flaws. None of this is surprising.
This Is Us, Creator. The first episode of Season 2 holds a giant piece of the puzzle. By Eliana Docterman. This Is Us could have been a gimmick. The very first episode ended with a twist when it revealed that the disparate stories of five different characters are actually one interconnected tale about a family. It could have been a tearjerker. Fans have wept at the trailer alone. It could have been the sort of network drama that loses its fans because of all its twists and turns. Many fans are still tuning in for the big mystery of how family patriarch Jack Milo Ventimiglia died. But instead, it turned out to be a drama with true depth, the story of a family struggling with identity, loss, self-image, career slumps, and rebuilding broken connections. When the second season of NBC's This Is Us premieres on September 26th, creator Dan Fogelman will need to prove that the biggest show on network television has staying power. The actors have helped him on that front. Sterling K. Brown won an Emmy last week for his role as Randall Pearson. This season, Fogelman says the Pearson children, Brown, Chrissy Metz, and Justin Hartley, and their mother, Mandy Moore, will find themselves on a wildly different journey than what the audience might expect. Fogelman spoke to Time about why he doesn't understand the controversy over Chrissy Metz's character, how his own mother's passing inspired the series' bittersweet tone, and what we'll learn about Jack's death in Season 2. Time. What was it like to watch Sterling K. Brown win the Best Actor Emmy? Dan Fogelman. It's easy to be happy for Sterling. He's so incredibly gracious. He worked a full day after the Emmys and brought the Emmy to the set. He made a beautiful speech to the crew about sharing the award with everybody, and everyone went home with a selfie with Sterling holding the Emmy. This Is Us was originally conceived as a film involving octuplets. How did you cull these characters down to just three for the series? I realized I had to pull back on some. There was a woman who had developed an English accent, like some Americans do when they move to England, to throw you off the scent that she was a sibling. There was an actor who was in the midst of a divorce, which was something that is obviously very much the opposite of the couples in our show. Those were two main ones that were getting the most screen time in the film. I just culled it down to what it felt like were the most essential characters, the big three and the parents. The show is very hopeful. Even when bad things happen, they seem to happen for a reason. Is that your life philosophy? It's my philosophy and the philosophy of the people who seem to be working on and enjoying the show. Personally, I have what I hope is a realistic view of the world, but it's also a positive view of the world. I'm aware of what's going on in this country, how divided and divisive and scary everything is right now. But I like to think the best of people, and I like to think out of loss or tragedy or dark moments can come goodness or improvement or growth. I think that's the philosophy of a great many people, including the actors and the writers and the directors of this show. But it's not like we set out to do a show about that. It's more like it's kind of something that's intrinsic to all of us, and I think it's coming through on the show. Have you always been such an optimist? I lost my mom very suddenly and very tragically, and we were very, very close. It's something that intrinsically is in my bones right now, which is taking a hardship or taking something that is difficult and finding light on the other side of it. I'm finishing a film right now that explores similar territory to This Is Us. I'm not setting out to necessarily do that, but I guess it's something that's been in my mind in the past decade. How do you balance tear-jerking twists with that uplifting message? Our second season revolves around this death that everyone's been talking about for the last year. So there's a natural kind of darkness and sadness that informs the second season of our show, both in that storyline and other storylines. It's going to be very sad and brutal at times in many different ways. But we're taking great pains right now to make sure that when the show gets very sad, and it does get very sad, whether if it's in an episode or four episodes down the line, that the gentle journey of the season will ultimately always be uplifting. That's what we're keeping our eye on this season. Does that mean that we're going to find out how said death happened at some point this season? Yeah, I think it's fair to say that kind of mystery or conversation about that will have evolved into new stuff by the end of the season. The first episode holds a giant piece of the puzzle that I think will feed the beast the appetite of people wanting to know what happens without giving every single answer. And the season in general will be a journey to understand all that and what happened in that year. How has people's response to the series changed how you write it, if at all? I try not to read too much because I don't want to change what we're doing. But we all do. We see it and we hear it. I think, if anything, both the popularity of the show and how important it has become to a lot of people in terms of seeing themselves reflected in it, whether they be things like transracial adoption or anxiety and nervous breakdowns, it makes us continue to want to treat things responsibly. We want to get it right. We don't want this show to become an issue of the week show, but because it's real life, we do explore a lot of different things. I've been touched in my family by body image issues. We bring in a lot of speakers. We do a lot of research. We feel like we have this microphone right now, and we want to make sure that we use it responsibly. There's been some criticism around Chrissy's character and whether her storylines could focus on more than just her mission to lose weight. I've read all the criticism. To me, it is so bizarre that that even got any kind of traction. This idea that Kate's story is only about her weight? In the course of a first season of this show, this woman was figuring out her career, dealing with processing the loss of a parent, in a love triangle with two different men, embarking on a romance, deciding at the end of the first season that she wants to embark on a singing career. The one that started her story was the journey about her wanting to attack her weight, which is a big storyline for that character. As someone who lived with a family of people and has a writer's room that's full of people who have battled weight and body image issues, it is a driving force for a lot of people. But to say that her storyline is only about weight is like saying that Randall's story is only about his identity or Kevin's story is only about his acting career. They are starting points for where we started the series. I think it's one of those things that is very easy for people who haven't really been touched by body image issues to say, "I wish you had a story about weight different than what you do." They don't quite get it, is my personal opinion. I wrote it, so what the hell do I know? What kind of stories can people look forward to this season besides the big mystery? It's hard not to spoil anything because I think our storylines are a little surprising. Everything starts in the first episode, picking back up where we left off this season, which is Kate is embarking on a singing career, Kevin is at this crossroads with his potential movie career, Sophie and Randall are contemplating adoption, and Rebecca and Jack are at this crossroads in their marriage. That is definitely the storyline we follow through in the first episode, but all three of their storylines for the big three go in very surprising directions. It's hard to talk about them without giving stuff away, but I think at the midpoint of our season, they'll be a place where you wouldn't have expected them to be after watching the first episode.
The Workplace Battleground. Ellen Powell and Gretchen Carlson sat down to discuss sexual harassment and the fight to be included at the office, by Lucy Feldman. In 2012, before inequality in Silicon Valley became a household conversation, venture capitalist Ellen Powell filed a lawsuit against her former firm, Kleiner Perkins, claiming she'd been held back because of her gender and retaliated against for complaining. Powell lost her case in a landmark trial in 2015, but the protracted battle helped draw attention to an essential conversation about discrimination. In 2016, on the other side of the country and in a different industry, former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson sued then-chairman Roger Ailes for sexual harassment and retaliation. Her case sparked a wave of similar claims from other women at the company, including Megyn Kelly, Lori Loon, and Andrea Tentaros. Carlson's contract with Fox had included an arbitration clause, which would have required her to privately resolve any dispute with the company. Instead, she sued Ailes directly and ultimately settled with the network, which acted on Ailes' behalf for $20 million.
Powe and Carlson opened doors for others to report mistreatment, and both women cemented themselves as leaders in the fight for inclusion in the workplace, even as they battled sexist criticism and skepticism of their claims. This fall, Powe publishes Reset, My Fight for Inclusion and Lasting Change, which reveals details about her experience at Kleiner Perkins. And Carlson will release Be Fierce, Stop Harassment and Take Your Power Back, offering advice to victims. Time brought these two women together for their first meeting, where they discussed responses, both the ugly and the inspiring, to their stories. They opened up about their shared drive to advocate for change and the importance of supporting those who speak out against harassment and discrimination. Unless you've been in a personal experience like you and I have, you don't understand the fear of coming forward, Carlson says to Powe. You and I sort of jumped off the cliff. You can watch the interview in its entirety at time.com. Puerto Rico is recovering much more slowly than Texas and Florida. By Pratik Rabala. Nearly a week after Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico, the Department of Energy reports that almost all of the island's 1.57 million residents are still without electricity. Maria, which directly hit the island as a Category 4 hurricane in the early hours of September 20th, caused widespread damage to the territory's aging power grid. By evening, most of the island was in complete darkness. The blackout is partially due to the island's aging infrastructure. Its power plants are 44 years old on average, compared with the industry average of 18 years. In a report in April, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, Puerto Rico's only power supplier, noted that years of underinvestment have led to severe degradation of infrastructure. To get a sense for how devastating Puerto Rico's power situation has become, three pairs of images taken by a NOAA satellite compare the before and after nighttime imagery of Puerto Rico to that of areas of Florida affected by Hurricane Irma and Texas affected by Hurricane Harvey. The images show that in many parts of Texas and Florida, power was either unaffected or largely restored within several days. While Irma knocked out 59% of all electricity in Florida, all but about 17% of customers saw their power restored 5 days after the storm. In Puerto Rico, however, almost no power has been restored to the island since Hurricane Maria. And there's no sign that it will get better soon. PREPA was still working on restoring power to about 60,000 residents following Hurricane Irma as Maria made landfall. Governor Ricardo Rosselló told CNN that it could take months to fully restore power to the island. PREPA's financial and political troubles further complicate recovery efforts since it filed for bankruptcy in July. Five luxury tree houses you can buy right now, by Mahita Gajanan. Tree houses have come a long way since the wooden planks wedged between branches of your childhood. Today, you can purchase an entire home situated among trees in many of the more leafy parts of the U.S. If a life amid the treetops and away from the ground appeals to you, consider buying a treehouse to live out your childhood dream. Right now, there are luxurious treehouses on the market for up to $3 million across the country, including in California, Virginia, and Louisiana. Off Lake Tahoe in Truckee, California, is a luxury four-bedroom, five-bathroom treehouse that costs about $3 million. A hand-forged circular staircase winds around a pine tree that acts as the anchor for the house. And closer to Los Angeles is a $289,000 treehouse in Lake Arrowhead. The two-bedroom, two-bathroom treehouse is surrounded by trees, and the surrounding area offers plenty of opportunities for fishing and hiking. If you're looking for a more Pacific Northwest-style vibe, check out a treehouse on sale in Kilscene, Washington. For $2.3 million, you can buy a three-bedroom, two-bathroom treehouse on a stilt setup that gives you a bird's-eye view of the ground. The 2,250-square-foot home comes with an open-air patio so you can fully enjoy the surrounding forest. Moving across the country, you'll find treehouses for sale in North Carolina, Louisiana, and Virginia. Head to the Smoky Mountains for a treehouse in Whittier, North Carolina, that comes with an expansive outdoor porch for $625,000. The three-bedroom, three-bathroom house is close to local hiking trails and other outdoor activities. Down in Louisiana, you can camp with style among the trees in a lofted treehouse that comes with a screened-in porch for $125,000. Or check out the hexagonal treehouse in Fancy Gap, Virginia, where a two-bedroom, two-bath treehouse is on the market for $94,000. Maine wants a lobster emoji. Here's what five other states should request. By Chris Wilson. Independent Senator Angus King of Maine has a modest request for the council that oversees emojis. Consider the lobster. New emojis require the approval of a group called the Unicode Consortium, which oversees this pantheon of modern hieroglyphics, among other efforts to standardize text across the web. As King's letter notes, there is currently an emoji for the crab, but not for his state's largest export, which is booming in sales thanks in large part to a growing taste for the crustacean in China. Maine shipped $382 million in lobsters last year, though the total economic impact of the industry is much greater. If Maine is going to request that its favorite export be christened in pixels, it stands to reason that other senators should want their state's economy represented in emojis as well. While many states chiefly export beef, pork, and chicken, all from animals that already have emojis, we consulted state export data and found five other food items that rake in millions of dollars for states but are missing from the lineup. And we start with California, almonds. This popular snack generated $3.2 billion in revenue to the state in 2016. Alaska, salmon. Alaska exports a variety of types of salmon, as well as the Alaska pollock. To be fair, there's already a fish emoji, but it does not look as tasty. Massachusetts, scallops. While lobsters are also Massachusetts' chief aquatic export, scallops are a $100 million industry. Montana, lentils. This protein-rich legume is Montana's third most lucrative export after cigarettes and civilian aircraft parts. And finally, Pennsylvania, cocoa. The home of Hershey exported $184 million in cocoa last year.
Five weight loss tips from people who've actually done it, by Alexandra Sifferlin. Most Americans want to lose weight, but it's no simple feat. Just ask someone who's done it. That's exactly what Time did in a recent cover story looking at new weight loss science. After speaking to people who had successfully lost weight after failing many times, it became clear that there's no best way to go about it. Instead, evidence, both scientific and anecdotal, show that it's possible for anyone to reach a healthy weight through a strategy that works best for them. Here's what worked for five people who lost weight and kept it off. First, go slow and steady. I've been overweight my entire life. I'd try different diets, lose a few pounds, and then gain it back. When I turned 25, I was 485 pounds, and I knew I was fighting for my life. I want to have kids one day and be more active with my husband. I wanted to stop sitting on the sidelines of my own life. At the beginning of 2016, I started tracking my calories, working out, and making healthier versions of the foods I loved. Ultimately, I fell in love with taking care of myself. My advice is to focus on each day, not how far you have to go. Weight loss is a journey, not a sprint. Lexi Reed, age 26, lost 278 pounds in 16 months. Number two, keep a journal. Don't just write down everything you eat. Write down how you feel that day, what's going on in your life, and how you feel after eating. After a while, look through your journal for patterns. Chances are you'll find some. I'm a recovering food addict, and nothing was more freeing than realizing what behaviors or events were triggering my addiction. It wasn't that I had no willpower. My brain was reacting to certain habits that made it hard for my willpower to do its job. Once I removed those patterns, like keeping cookies around the house, my willpower muscle could finally flex. Erica Nicole Kendall, 33, lost 170 pounds over 2 years. Number 3, give yourself a break. You don't have to eat salad all the time to lose weight. There are so many ways to tweak ingredients and make food you actually love to eat, even pancakes. Try almond flour. That being said, the type of food you eat also defines your lifestyle. You can eat junk food and lose weight, but you'll probably be hungry all the time. So give yourself an occasional cheat day or reward for sticking to your plan. In the end, you want to lose weight in a healthy way without feeling like you're hurting yourself. Nivedith Renga, age 26, lost 65 pounds in 9 months. 4. Find something that sticks. When I graduated college in 2012, I was at my highest weight ever. I was embarrassed about my weight and what I looked like, and I was terrified of being the person in the gym who didn't know what they were doing. I sat in my doctor's office and remember deciding that I was going to do whatever it took, however long it took, to change my life. I tried a variety of different diets that worked, but I felt like I was losing my mind, not being able to eat certain foods, and I hated that even though I was quote-unquote losing weight, I still had a really disordered relationship with food. Food is supposed to bring joy and happiness. I decided to give macro counting a whirl. It's similar to calorie counting, but rather than keeping track of your calories, you keep track of the number of grams of protein, fat, and carbs you eat per day. Following this is what ended up giving me the biggest change overall. I felt like I wasn't starving myself or depriving myself to lose weight. You have to find something you can stick to. What works for one person may not work for another. Whatever you choose, it has to be for life. Kelly Rojek, 27, lost 50 pounds in 18 months. And number 5, manage expectations. You have to make slow and steady adjustments. That worked for me. I measured and weighed food to become more aware of portion size. I wrote down what I ate and ate more frequent, smaller meals throughout the day. I try to include protein in each meal to control hunger. I don't deprive myself, and I've gotten rid of all-or-nothing thinking. People could still look at me and consider me overweight. You have to accept you're never going to be a willowy model, but I'm at a very good weight that I can manage. Jody Jeans, 52, lost 75 pounds over 5 years. Power poses don't actually work. Try these confidence-boosting strategies instead. By Jeffrey Kluger. Just how powerful are power poses? Not very, as it turns out. Ever since a widely read study was published in Psychological Science in 2010, which showed that taking a moment alone before an important meeting to assume one of two power poses can boost your self-confidence and even change your hormone levels, power poses have become a self-help sensation. The poses are simple and are common among powerful people. Sitting back in a chair with your feet on a desk and your fingers laced behind your neck, or standing and leaning in toward a desk supporting your weight with your fingertips. A TED Talk delivered by Amy Cuddy, an associate professor at Harvard Business School and a co-author of the study, has been viewed an astounding 43 million times. And no wonder. As the paper's introduction promises, a person can, by assuming two simple one-minute poses, embody power and instantly become more powerful. Or not. According to 11 recently released studies in two different journals, Comprehensive Results in Social Psychology, CRSP, and Social Psychological and Personality Science, the original paper was flawed, so flawed that it now appears power poses don't do much of anything at all. Researchers attempting to replicate the results with a larger study group, 200 people, compared to the original study's 42, failed to duplicate the confidence-boosting effect. The original study also measured the effects of the poses in a contrived laboratory setting, measuring how many risky decisions people made in a low-stakes gambling task after the poses. Not exactly the same pressures faced when making a big presentation to the boss or asking for a raise. What we've found is that all of these effects are missing in the real world, says Joseph Cesario, an associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University who co-led the new research. If you hold a power pose for 2 minutes in a bathroom and then go negotiate with your boss, it's a different situation. There's another person in the room now, and that person is in a higher spot on the social hierarchy than you are. After multiple researchers failed to find the same results Cuddy did, one of the authors of the original 2010 paper, Dana Carney, associate professor at the University of California Berkeley School of Business, decided to work with Cesario on the new research. She reviewed the 7 papers in the CRSP collection, signed off on their validity, and co-authored an essay introducing them that detailed the problems with the original study. But while power poses no longer have scientific backing, researchers say there are other ways to improve your performance and people's perception of you in meetings. Body language matters. Carney argues that nonverbal displays in the presence of other people, not simply by yourself before a meeting, can make a real difference. Just as a smile still signals to others that a person feels good or is happy, certain nonverbal displays signal confidence and the possibility that one is higher within a given hierarchy, she says. The displays include an expansive or open posture, speaking more, looking at the other person while speaking, and initiating touch. Moderation is key here, since it's easy to cross the nonverbal line from confident to creepy. But done right, signaling your sense of authority helps people treat you accordingly, and that can be a confidence booster all by itself. Competence drives confidence. Even more important than boosting your confidence is boosting your competence, says Cesario. There's something great about feeling powerful and confident, he says. It can help you persist, but it works only when that sense comes from something real. If you're lacking competence, the best thing you can do is develop it. That can mean going back to school for additional training in a field that appeals to you, or accepting an entry-level job and learning as you go. Sometimes it means the simple muscle work of exhaustively preparing for a pitch meeting or a job interview. Cesario also suggests a sort of self-pacing throughout your career, neither overreaching nor underreaching as you pursue your goals. Setting moderately strong challenges along the way and seeing yourself achieve those is what can help, he advises. Certainly, there will always be room for a little self-psyching, the internal equivalent of a locker room speech before you take the field. If that includes stretching or posing in a way that both literally and metaphorically stiffens your spine, have at it. But a pose will always be just a pose, without the power of your skills to back it up. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.